This Writer Centre Norwich podcast is brought to you from the City of Literature programme at Norfolk and Norwich Festival 2016.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this evening's Harriet Martineau Lecture 2016. I'm John Morley from Writer Centre Norwich. It's my very great pleasure to introduce Linton Kwesi Johnson onto stage this evening. And I'd like to thank all the appropriate people and organisations. I hope I don't miss anyone. As well as our own staff at the Writers' Centre, I'd like to thank our funders at Arts Council England, Norfolk County Council, Norwich City Council, and the University of East Anglia. Thank you. I'd like to thank our co-organisers of tonight's event, the Norfolk Norwich Festival, of course, now nearing its closing weekend, and our host venue, Norwich Arts Centre. And given it's the Martineau Lecture, particular thanks go out to the former head of the Arts Centre as well, so that's Stuart Hobday. I think he's here tonight. He came up with the idea of the Martineau Lecture a few years ago, and so he's very much a brainchild between an annual event, so thanks, Stuart. Harriet Martineau, 1802 to 1876, was, as I'm sure you know, the world's first professionally retained journalist. She was central to the intellectual circles of her day, friends with the Wordsworths, the Darwins, Florence Nightingale, and she's said by some to have been the first English sociologist. She was a pioneering feminist, an abolitionist, and a world traveller, and a celebrated campaigner on a range of social issues. The Harriet Martineau Lecture aims to celebrate the legacy of this remarkable, world-changing woman, inviting radical writers to respond to an issue pertinent to Martineau, with a particular focus on marginalised voices. The first Harriet Martineau Lecture was delivered by Ali Smith, and featured a call to draw Harriet Martineau's face onto £5 notes in protest at Elizabeth Fry, another Norwich resident being rubbed off. The second Martineau Lecture was given by Kate Moss, exploring the role that women have played in fighting for progressive change throughout different periods in history. In 2015, the pioneering Russian journalist Masha Gessen joined us from political exile in New York to give a disturbing analysis of the latest trends in Putin's mismanagement of Russia. This year, it's my very great honour to introduce the internationally renowned writer and recording artist, Linton Kwesi Johnson. Born in 1952 in Clarendon, Jamaica, Linton Kwesi Johnson moved to London at 11 years old, attending Tulse Hill Comprehensive School in Brixton, and then Goldsmiths College, University of London, where he graduated in sociology. From the early 70s, he began making his name as a writer and political activist, joining the Black Panther movement and the Race Today collective, and speaking at rallies and demonstrations. His second collection of poems, Dread, Beat and Blood, 1977, was set to music by a backing band that included the bassist and Lovers Rock producer, Dennis Bovell. And from thenceforth, Linton continued to compose poems for both the stage and the page, releasing successive reggae albums, now recognised as classics of the genre, and launching his own label, LKJ Records. Ngugi Wa Thiong'o has written that these albums rank alongside the works of Gil Scott-Heron, The Last Poets and Fela Kuti as leading examples of orature, radical black artworks that transcend traditional genre boundaries and overcome the conditions of global diaspora to express the solidarity of black peoples. In an especially significant contribution to the literature of the Caribbean, Linton coined the now widely used phrase, dub poetry. That is poetry written with the rhythms of reggae music. To discuss the work of Jamaican poets, such as Oku Onuora, Michael Smith, and Muta Baruka, which was premeditated as opposed to the improvisatory toasting of Jamaican dancehall sound system DJs, and often contained a radical political agenda. When in 2010 a catastrophic earthquake struck Haiti, leaving over 200,000 people dead and millions homeless, the world was shocked into seeing the French-speaking Caribbean island, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, afresh. For many, this involved re-evaluating and responding to a classic work of Marxist historiography, The Black Jacobins, by the Trinidadian historian C.L.R. James, who lived from 1901 to 1989, one of the great Caribbean intellectuals. The Black Jacobins, a magisterial history of the 1791 Haitian Revolution, had foregrounded the agency of Haiti's enslaved masses in toppling the system of plantation slavery. James recounts with a formidable grasp of historical detail the lethal race war between whites, blacks and mulattoes that followed news of the French Revolution. He recounts the manoeuvrings of the rebel leader Toussaint Louverture and his generals, the expulsion of successive European armies from Haiti, and the eventual creation of the world's first black republic. Neglected and ignored by all the politicians of every brand and persuasion, the slaves, writes James, had organised on their own and struck for freedom at last. Given that Harriet Martineau too wrote about the Haitian Revolution in her three-volume novel, The Hour and the Man, we decided to invite Linton to Norwich in this context. His Martineau lecture breaks decisively with the humanist debates of an earlier generation, citing C.L.R. James' more rigorously dialectical approach before exploring how one might consider such issues today from the perspective of an African consciousness. Linton will chart this through the close textual analysis of a variety of reggae songs. After the lecture, we will engage in a short conversation and there will be a chance for a few questions from the audience and perhaps a book signing for you if you ask good questions. So, please welcome Linton Fraser Johnson.
Thank you very much. Good evening. When I was first invited to give the Harriet Martineau lecture, I didn't know very much about her. I still don't know very much about her. Reading her work, however, immediately brought another person to mind, C.L.R. James. I was well aware that the pairing of these two for the purpose of historical comparison may seem, on the surface, to be a facile exercise. Although a case can be made for historical connection, these two individuals belong to different worlds and were born a century apart. Martineau was a well-connected upper-class Englishwoman who was active in the anti-slavery movements on both sides of the Atlantic. James was a black Trinidadian Caribbean nationalist, Pan-Africanist, Marxist revolutionary. They both achieved great eminence as writers and intellectuals and were committed to radical reform and revolutionary change. They both produced important works on slavery. Martineau's two major works being Illustrations of Political Economy and Writings on Slavery and the American Civil War, and James, The Black Jacobins, and History of Negro Revolt. What is interesting about these two writers' works on slavery, however, is not their above-mentioned books, but their literary response to the Haitian Revolution of 1791, led by Toussaint Louverture. In Martineau's case, her novel, The Hour and the Man, and for James's play, Toussaint Louverture, written and performed before he wrote The Black Jacobins. Martineau's book is a historical novel peopled by characters both real and fictional. Her portrayal of Toussaint as a, quote, great Negro, unquote, is empathetic, a romantic view of the Haitian slave rebellion with moments of melodrama. James's play is devoid of sentimentality and focused on decisive episodes involving most of the main players. In both the novel and the play, Toussaint is depicted as a tragic hero. There are, of course, several literary works on Toussaint Louverture and the Haitian Revolution, including plays by Aimé Césaire, Edouard Glissant, Derek Walcott, and a poem by William Wordsworth. All these literary works are worthy of comparison by a student of literary studies. Martineau, as a child of the Enlightenment, should write a historical novel portraying to Saint L'Ouverture as a great man of sagacity, piety, and integrity, is entirely consistent with her liberal disposition and her activism as abolitionist and humanist, driven by a profound moral imperative. James's motivation is both personal and political. The Black Jacobins, his history of the Haitian Revolution, published in 1938 and still regarded as a masterpiece of historiography, was preceded by the play, which was written in 1934 and performed in 1936 at the Westminster Theatre in London, with Paul Robeson playing Toussaint. What James first wrote about Toussaint as early as 1931 in an essay titled The Intelligence of the Negro, published in the Trinidad Journal, The Beacon, that year. It was an eloquent reply to Dr. Sidney Harlan's racist article, Race Admixture, also published in The Beacon, which argued that white people were of superior intelligence to black people. James's riposte is evidence of his then nascent African consciousness, which later bloomed into his Pan-Africanist consciousness. As Christian Augsburg observes in the introduction to James's play, Toussaint L'Ouverture, first published in 2013, critical to James's movement towards Pan-Africanism was his study of the Haitian Revolution. The legacy of slavery still impinges on the lives of the African diaspora and continues to reverberate on our consciousness. The title of my talk is African Consciousness in Reggae Music, Some Examples. Andrea Levy's novel, The Long Song, set in Jamaica during the period before and after the abolition of slavery, chronicles the life of July, a mixed-race girl born into slavery. When the new master arrives on the plantation, July is anxious to distance herself from her African ancestry in order to impress him. She tells him, quote, "You must not think me a nigger, for me is mulatto," unquote. Rigorously researched, The Long Song credibly depicts a period of turbulence in Jamaica's troubled history and its impact on plantation life. Although Levy's book is fiction, it nevertheless offers historical context for a persistent ambivalence about race in Jamaica. Notwithstanding useful sociological concepts like pluralism, notions of compartmentalization, creolization, and hybridity, the fact is that race is an important dimension of Jamaican society and culture. It could be argued that Jamaica's national motto, "Out of many, one people," is but a fig leaf masking unpalatable truths, what the late Professor Rex Nettleford would probably dub obscenities about the nature of social relations in Jamaica. It seems to me that official society is in denial about the politics of race in Jamaica, a denial that Professor Mervyn Morris would probably describe as almost pathological. Jamaicans may have made progress in coming to terms with the multifaceted nature of our historical heritage, but we still have a long way to go in the decolonization of the mind. And yet Jamaican reggae music is replete with expressions of African consciousness. What do I mean by African consciousness? Simply, an awareness of connectedness to the continent of Africa by its diaspora as ancestral homeland and identification with Africa. Stuart Hall identifies two approaches to African consciousness: cultural nationalist and pan-African imaginary. The emphasis on the first being identity and the other solidarity. He opts for the latter because it is that approach, he asserts, that has kept the consciousness, or what he calls the connections, alive. I would argue that both the cultural nationalist and the Pan-African imaginary find expression in reggae music. There is ample historical and anthropological evidence that the slaves who were taken to the New World from Africa brought Africa with them, that African traditions were interwoven into the fabric of their cultural lives. In his book, The Development of Creole Society in Jamaica, 1770 to 1820, Kamau Brathwaite shows us that the orientation of the folk culture of Jamaican slaves was decidedly African. He offers as evidence customs related to the life cycle, sexual and domestic unions, death, funerals and burial, religious ideas and practice, dress, dance, and music. Moreover, the Maroons, runaway slaves, had established autonomous communities where African traditions and cultural practices thrived. Jamaican novelist and sociologist Erna Brodba rightly asserts in her book, The Continent of Black Consciousness, that slavery negated the tribal consciousness of the transported slaves and produced an African consciousness instead. The African slaves in the New World were molded into one people, sharing many things in common, including identity. Slavery made them into Africans. Brodba goes on to argue that this African consciousness provided the basis for the emergence of black political thought and action, which culminated in the emergence of black nationalist movements in the 20th century. Peter Tosh's song, African, provides a succinct expression of African consciousness.
Thank you.
black man, is gender neutral, Tosh's definition of African is inclusive and all-embracing. Don't care where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African, declares Tosh. It matters not what parish of Jamaica you're from, what part of the Caribbean you're from, what shade of black you are, what church you're affiliated to, what country you're from. If you're black, you're African. In May 2013, during the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the African Union in Addis Ababa, a panel on Pan-Africanism and the African Renaissance, Jamaican Prime Minister Portia Simpson Miller said that Jamaica and the Caribbean community are, quote, proud of our African heritage, unquote. It was Peter Tosh's song, African, that was played as former Jamaican Prime Minister P.J. Patterson and Mrs. Simpson Miller joined the panel on stage. Even before the emergence of reggae in the late 1960s, there were some expressions of African consciousness in Jamaican popular music. The work of the folklorist Olive Lewin provides evidence that there are a number of Jamaican folk songs in which Africa is remembered. Songs which mention Congo and Guinea, for example. Noted jazz musician and musicologist Marjorie Wiley is an expert on African-derived drum rhythms like Kumina, Etu, Buru, Gere, Gombe, and Nago, which are still played in Jamaica. During the era of ska, the visionary trombonist Don Drummond named one of his instrumental compositions Addis Ababa, after the Ethiopian capital, and another, The Reburial, in reference to the reinterment in Jamaica of Marcus Garvey, the greatest and most effective political advocate of black African consciousness. Prince Buster, in his famous talking tune, Judge Dredd, declares that he has come from Ethiopia to preside over the trial of rude boys in Jamaica charged with robbing and shooting black people. Buster's black nationalist sentiment can be heard in several of his recordings, including Blackhead Chinaman, where he castigates the singer Derek Morgan for leaving his stable to go and record for a Jamaican Chinese producer. During the short rocksteady period between ska and reggae, that is 1966 to 1968, we begin to get songs like Desmond Dekker's Pretty Africa, expressing the sentiments of Garvey's Back to Africa movement and the Rastafarian demand for repatriation. In the song, Dekker describes Africa as, quote, the land of our fathers, where we belong. Rastafarian movement and the alienation felt by the poor and marginalized youth of urban Jamaica ensured that the theme of repatriation would become a consistently restated one in many reggae recordings. Send I back to Ethiopia land, It is our father's land, Silam, sing the aptly named Ethiopians in one of their early recordings. In another song from the Rocksteady period, Bob Andy declares, "I've got to go back home. Jamaica couldn't be home, cause I can't get clothes to wear, can't get no food to eat, can't find a job to get bread. Nothing like a future here." The persona of the song threatens to commit suicide if he cannot leave. Sense of alienation, unbelonging, and hopelessness, rooted in the failure of the abolition of slavery to radically transform the lives of the former slaves, and disillusionment with the material conditions of post-colonial existence for the poor and marginalized urban youth, find expression in many reggae songs. Over a decade after Jamaica's independence, during the turbulent 1970s, Rastafarian singer Fred Lox still finds inspiration in the ill-fated Black Star Liner shipping company, which Marcus Garvey's UNIA had established to transport New World blacks to Africa. 7 miles of Black Star Liners coming in the harbor, announces Fred Lox. For him, this is a vision of the fulfillment of Garvey's prophecy of freedom, a vision that persists among some Rastafarians. "It is repatriation, black liberation," chants Fred Lox. Marcus Garvey's currency had declined by the time of his death in 1940. As Colin Grant tells us in his book, Negro with a Hat, quote, "It wasn't until when crisis hit the black world with the rise of the militant black power movement in the United States of America in the 1960s and the emergence of black leaders in Africa and the Caribbean seeking to forge new national identities that people started to think again of Garvey," unquote. Burning Spear's old Marcus Garvey, was released around the same time as Fred Locke's Black Star Liners. By then, Garvey was not only one of Jamaica's national heroes, he was back in currency. But whilst Fred Locke reaffirms the Garveyite vision of African redemption, Burning Spear laments its betrayal. All of Jamaica's national heroes are being talked about, sings Burning Spear, but no one remembers Marcus Garvey, is the song's paradoxical refrain. Nanny of the Maroons, Jamaica's only national heroine, is not mentioned in the song. Some expressions of African consciousness in reggae take the form of statements of pride in African ancestry, like Johnny Clark's African Roots, for example, where he sings, quote, "We've been taken away from Africa more than 500 years. But one thing they couldn't take was the roots out of my mind. African roots, just call me African roots," unquote. At the heart of African consciousness in reggae music is the historical experience of slavery, its legacy of brutality, exploitation, marginalization, hopelessness, and centuries of colonial indoctrination of black inferiority. A common theme of many expressions of African consciousness in reggae music is that of remembering. "Do you remember the days of slavery?" asks Burning Spear rhetorically in his song "Slavery Days." Thank you. the song Africa from their 1976 album Right Time, the Mighty Diamonds not only declare that Africa, their ancestral land, is calling them home, slavery is memorialized. Quote, "I remember those chains, how my people was in slavery long, long time ago." Bob Marley sings, "I remember on the slave ship how they brutalized our very soul." Marley's invocation of the memory of slavery in Slave Driver is about retributive justice. Slave driver, the table is turned. Catch a fire, you're gonna get burned. Fire is still a potent metaphor of retribution in Rastafarian discourse. Like Marley's slave driver, Peter Tosh's 400 years, Burning Spear's old Marcus Garvey, and Bob Andy's I've Got to Go Back Home are not just expressions of African consciousness, they also critique post-colonial Jamaica. Sometimes expressions of African consciousness in reggae take the form of naming. For example, groups give themselves names like the Abyssinians, the Congos, the Ethiopians, and the Burning Spear. The Burning Spear was the name of Jomo Kenyatta. Solo artists give themselves names like Queen Ifrika, Sizzla Kolanje, and Muta Baruka. Cedric Brooks names two of his instrumental compositions Tales of Mozambique and Nigerian Reggae. Some songs lament the loss of identity. In Give I Fear a Name, Pablo Moses demands of the colonizer the return of his original African name. Chinese are called Chin and Chung, he says. Macintosh is from Scotland, and Indians are called Raja and Gavaska. Moreover, he is sure that Smith is not an African name. He tells us of his embarrassment on reaching Ethiopia, having to tell his friends his name is Morris. Having rejected the colonizer's name, the singer opts for Spanish and Jewish names, Pablo Moses. Similarly, during the era of ska, Lord Brinner, in the topically titled Congo War, treats the theme of loss of name with irony. Thank you. Africa becomes iconic and takes on a utopian dimension in some reggae songs. The group Third World, for example, mythologized Africa in their song Tribal War as a place where there was an absence of tribal conflict. The Abyssinians in Sakamasagana describe Africa as a land far, far away where there's no night, there's only day. The lyrics of Bonnie Wailer's Dreamland can be interpreted as a utopian, romanticized vision of Africa. Incidentally, although Bonnie Wailer claims that he penned this song Dreamland, it's really a reworking of an old American R&B song by a group called the El Tempos, which was called Dream Isle. When anti-colonial and anti-apartheid struggles were being waged in Africa during the 1970s and 1980s, some expressions of African consciousness were couched in the language of Pan-Africanism. These were basically statements of solidarity, like the Abyssinians' South African enlistment, for example. If Africa not free, black man can't free, declared the Twinkle Brothers in their song Free Africa. Thank you. "Africa must be free by the year 1983, sang the youthful Hugh Mundell. There was Tapazuki's celebratory MPLA, alluding to the victory of the revolutionary forces in Angola during the anti-colonial war against the Portuguese, with its banal chorus, MPLA, not going on a holiday. Bob Marley's Zimbabwe celebrates the triumph of the liberation struggle in that country and calls for unity of purpose, a call he repeats in Africa Unite." Just a few of the examples of the many varied expressions of African consciousness in reggae music. I haven't even scratched at the surface. There was a marked decline in these expressions during the 1980s, which coincided with the decline of roots reggae and the ascendancy of dancehall DJ ragamuffin music. In Jamaica, out went the People's National Party and Democratic Socialism, and in came the Jamaica Labour Party, IMF structural adjustment policies with slapness and gun talk in the dance hall. By the early 1990s, roots reggae began a tentative revival, and by the end of the 20th century, dance hall music had begun to reflect once again African consciousness through artists like Garnet Silk, Sizzla, Capleton, and Morgan Heritage, and others. This revival was itself a reflection of a new wave of Rasta revival amongst the youth of Jamaica, with the rise of the Boboshanti Dreads, followers of Prince Emmanuel. The re-diasporization of the New World Blacks in Europe, as Stuart Hall calls it, saw the establishment of a Caribbean diaspora in Britain. My generation developed not only a West Indian or Caribbean consciousness, we also developed an African consciousness. In racialized Britain, the legacy of slavery, which resulted in post-World War II migration and which still impinges on our lives, a continuity of consciousness was inevitable. In the same way that the slaves had brought Africa with them to the New World, black people brought Africa with them from the Caribbean to Britain. The Black Power movement of the late 1960s and early 70s was a political expression of African consciousness in the United Kingdom, as well as a black working class movement. For second and third generation young blacks in Britain, reggae music was an important factor in the formation of new identities of belonging and unbelonging. Reggae music through sound systems provided a nexus for a culture of resistance to racial oppression. So expressions of African consciousness in Jamaican reggae we socialized around were an important influence. It also facilitated the growth of Rastafari in Britain. British reggae too reflected a continuity of African consciousness through bands like Aswad, Matumbi, Misty in Roots, Steel Pulse, and the DJ Maccabee, and others. The success of Bob Marley and his elevation on the world stage as a superstar had inspired a new generation of British roots reggae exponents. Although lovers rock, that particularly British genre of romantic reggae continues to hold its own, by the end of the 20th century, roots reggae in the UK began to decline, and with it, expressions of African consciousness in the music of young black people in Britain. The technologically driven music of young blacks at the start of the new millennium seems to reflect more the realities of urban life and the dominant consumerist ethos of our time. This American-influenced ethos is also to be found in the music coming out of Jamaica. However, expressions of African consciousness still continue in reggae and dancehall music in Jamaica today, 500 years after Africans were first brought to Jamaica. To summarize then, African consciousness is rooted in the Atlantic slave trade, the historical experience of slavery and its legacy. A cultural dimension of this consciousness is its expression in reggae music. These are often expressions of despair and affirmation, defiance and illusion, resistance and hope. The Jamaican diaspora in the UK facilitated a continuity of expression which influenced formations of black British identities. Whilst expressions of African consciousness declined in Jamaican popular music during the 1980s, it endures in the 21st century in Jamaica, but has declined in Britain. This decline reflects the demise of reggae music as the dominant music of today's British black youth. Thank you.
To C.L.R. James, who started it, because of course you knew him in England, didn't you?
Yes, during Nello's, that's what we call him, Nello. During Nello's last years, he spent his time in Brixton, in London, living upstairs in the top floor of the building which houses the Race to the Collective. And I was a member of the collective, and all of us, you know, had a hand in looking after them. I was one of his golfers, you know. He was a lovely man, and I would sit by his bedside and talk to him from time to time. I don't know if you ever saw a film called Upon Westminster Bridge. It was made by Arena in 1982, directed by Anthony Wall. It was about the Jamaican poet Michael Smith, late Michael Smith, and there's a scene in the film where both myself and Michael are by C.L. James' bedside and discussing poetry. And he's talking about Ode to the Nightingale and how this poem was written after the French Revolution. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was an original interpretation of a poem that I never heard before. Like, you know, he said Keats was saying that all that people had hoped for was lost. And, you know, the Nightingale was a metaphor. The song of the Nightingale was a metaphor for the sadness that the poet felt, or whatever. Anyway, what I really wanted to mention was that Michael Smith was trying to wind up Nell and kept on calling Shakespeare Shakespeare. And that really pissed him off. When I used to sit by his bedside, it was mostly like an interrogation, pretty much like what you're doing here now. And he would want to ask me what countries I performed my music in, what kind of venues they were, how many people attended the concert, how much money I got, and all this kind of thing. And I told him, and back from those days, he said, yeah, you've done something important, you should write it all down in a book.
So he was a very erudite man, I imagine. And who else was in the Race to the Collective? There must be Darkest Hour.
Darkest Hour was the editor of the journal. And there were other people. There was Farouk Dundee, who later became a commissioning editor at Channel 4. That was when Channel 4 had a multicultural brief. There were people like Leila Hassan and from the Black Unity and Freedom Party. We're basically a collective made up of people from the Black Power era. Myself and Darkest and Farouk were in the Panthers. Leila Hassan and Gene Ambrose and Claudia Spillman were in the Black Unity and Freedom Party. And there were a few other people from another organization. We all got together and won the Race to the Collective.
Amazing years. Michael Smith, of course, met a tragic fate, didn't he, in Jamaica? He was stoned to death by, I believe, JLP supporters.
Yes, Michael really didn't really support any political party in Jamaica. He was equally scared about both of them. But he attended a rally near where he lived, or near where his mother lived, a place called Stony Hill, where a Jamaican government minister was speaking. Her name was Mavis Gilmore. I believe she was the Minister of Education at the time. Anyway, Michael began to heckle her. And after the meeting, he was confronted by a couple of thugs from the Jamaica Labour Party. And an argument ensued, and the stones were thrown. Michael was hit and died from his wounds.
You don't really read scenes like that in Martineau's novels. You'd have to go to someone like Marlon James, I think, to sort of see the descriptions of this sort of side of Jamaican C.L.R. James optimistic or pessimistic at the end?
He was an eternal optimist. An eternal optimist. So. And I was saddened that he didn't, I think he died in 89 or 88 or thereabouts. He didn't see the changes in Europe, in the implosion of the Soviet Union and so on, which he had predicted.
May I ask Winston about your views on Rastafarianism? Because it came
I don't have any view on Rastafarianism. As you can see, I'm a bald head.
People at the drum said there were different ways of practicing Rasta.
I don't know anything about that. All I can tell you about Rastafari is that as a youngster growing up, I identified with Rastafari. Right? I regarded it as part of my cultural heritage. And I felt like it was an important cultural force trying to do something about the 400 years of colonial brainwashing to which black people in Jamaica have been subjected.
Yeah. Colin Grant's book, if anyone hasn't seen it, it's about the way it's brilliant in the way it kind of digs down into the history, about the way it talks about Haile Selassie's visit in the 70s and sort of goes into this huge growth of the music, which is the religion, sorry, which was rural, I think, primarily. And it sort of really surprised the Jamaican police force and government, I think, when these tens of thousands of Rastas came on to greet Selassie coming off his aeroplane, and they had not been categorized, counted before. You know, it's a fascinating story.
I'm not going to say anything about that. I just wanted to, I just suddenly remembered that of the Wailers, Bob Marley and the Wailers, it was Bob Marley, Peter Tosh and Bonnie Wailer. Of the three of them, Peter Tosh was the most militant. He was actually a political activist and was involved in street protests and demonstrations and so on, and was badly brutalized by the police in Kingston on a number of occasions.
We go to hear any questions from the floor. Could I get a show of hands to sort of judge how many people might want to ask a question? Hand over there. I think I need to relinquish my microphone to one of you to take a question, if that's okay.
They've all played this stage in the last 3 or 4 years, and I just thought it was rather interesting that you underscored that with your talk about reggae and slavery. And just like, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Two rows further forward. Front.
Hello, thank you. You talk about the dream of going home. Yes,
after Haile Selassie's visit to Jamaica, he made a grant of land to Rastafarians wanting to go back to Africa in a place called Shashamani. And there is, right now, a community of Rastafarians living in Shashamani. And some black people went back to Africa. When I say back to Africa, there's some black people, some Jamaicans migrated to Africa of their own volition. There's a significant Jamaican community in Gambia, for example. You'll find Jamaicans in Ghana.
Questions?
consequence of a number of things. One, we built autonomous political organizations and we organized ourselves and agitated and fought against racial oppression in this country. We had to resort to riots and insurrections and uprisings. But by the end of the 80s, we'd managed to integrate ourselves into British society. Prior to that, we were on the periphery of British society. Even though we came from the empire, when my parents' generation were coming in, we were coming to the mother country. But they were in for a rude awakening when they arrived in the 50s. I think the first watershed moment came in 1981, after 13 black children were murdered in an arson attack on a house at 439 New Cross Road in Southeast London. In the period leading up to that fire, there was a big controversy about West Indian parties, people playing this reggae music, this loud music, and disturbing people, and some politicians were adding oil to the flame. There was an arson attack on the house, and 13 young black children died, 26 were seriously injured. The black communities responded by forming the New Cross Massacre Action Committee. And on the 2nd of March, launched the Black People's Day of Action, when something like between 15 to 20,000 people marched from 439 New Cross Road in Southeast London to Hyde Park to protest the death of the young people and the way the matter had been handled by the authorities, and to hand in a letter to number 10 Downing Street. It made the British establishment sit up and take note of the fact that we have some power and that we could mobilize that power. It was a watershed moment. A month after that, we had the Brixton riots, sparked by an operation called Operation Swamp 81, where the police went about stopping and searching people going about their everyday lawful business. You know, and a lot of bitterness had been building up over a number of years. And of course, the riots in Brixton spread to nearly every inner city area. So that year, 1981, was a turning point. And it was soon after that, a few years after that, ironically, under a Tory government, that things began to change slowly. I think Michael Heseltine had a hand in that, as the minister in charge of the environment. Launched this inner city partnership, and they began to introduce race equality policies in local government and so on and so on and so forth. And we begin to see the emergence of a black middle class. The second watershed moment came with the inquiry into the racist murder of Stephen Lawrence, inquiry led by a man called McPherson, which found that the British police force were institutionally racist. Another significant watershed moment. But yes, we've come a far way from where we were when I arrived here in 1963, when black people lived in one room apartments and so on. Old families living in one room, apartments, and so on. We've come a long way. We have members of parliament, we have people in local government. I remember one time one of my boys got into trouble with the police, and when we went to court, the prosecutor was black, and his lawyer was black. So that is a measure of how far we've come.
Very considerable corpus of work. Two of, I think, Lindsay's most powerful poems, of course, are New Cross Massacre and The Great Insurrection, which respectively give voice to the grief and outrage firstly the firebombing, and secondly the rioting in 1985. I know two of you were very great at work. We have time, I think, for one more question. Who would like to ask it? Don't be shy. Yes, a hand at the back. Back there by the railing. Here's the mic. That's it. Pass the mic back.
Vincent, I've been listening to your music since I was a teenager, and then, of course, your music was the sort of soundtrack to the 80s and the riots, and I remember Forces of Victory, and I remember listening to it thinking, well, that has to be a crack track somewhere along the line, there was. But what do you think of music now? What do you think of UK grime, drum and bass, and do you think it comes from the same roots? Does it have the same
edge? Yes, it does. It does. There is a direct connection to reggae. Dub music, which was the drum and bass version of reggae with sound effects and so on. Dub music basically being the art of the recording engineer, because it's about creating soundscapes. Out of that came jungle, and then out of that came, and also out of that came dubstep and grime. It's Dizzy Rascal and all these guys are doing is in the same tradition as the reggae DJs of the 70s. So. What do I think of it? I don't listen to too much of it. I'm at that age now where I tend to listen to old music. But I like some of it, you know. I mean, I see Dizzy Rascal on the TV and I think he's got a lot of wit. He's very funny and, you know, he's got a good groove going. You know.
But your lectures ended on a sad note. You said reggae was on its way out.
Well, not that reggae is on its way out, that African consciousness in the music in this country is on its way out. And that it went through a period of decline in Jamaica, but has now reasserted itself again.
Thank you. Well, I for one have both a reading list and a playlist as long as my arm on the back of tonight's talk. So I'd just like to thank Lyndsey Crazy Johnson once again for such an interesting Martin Lecture, please.